In the first hour of the show today, we'll be talking about the current state of the Catholic Church, particularly the Catholic Church in America, where it is now and what it might be in the future. And clearly, the Church is in crisis. Recently, within the last couple of years, the main focus of concern has been revelations about sexual misconduct by priests. But even before that, discontent had been growing for a number of years among the laity, that is, the people in the pews, and also between the church's middle management, the bishops, and the leadership at the very top in Rome. And all of this certainly came to a head with the stories that we've been hearing and reading over the last couple of years, has led the church to, let some people ask the question, will the church, might the church actually come apart, or might it become something new? We'll try to explore some of these issues this morning in this hour of the show as we talk with David Gibson. He is an award-winning religion writer. He writes frequently about Catholicism for various newspapers and magazines. He has produced television documentaries on the church for CNN. He worked in Rome for Vatican Radio for several years and is the author of a recently published book titled The Coming Catholic Church, the subtitle How the Faithful Are Shaping a New American Catholicism. It's published by Harper San Francisco, and you should be able to find it in bookstores if you're interested in reading it. Questions, of course, are welcome, as always, as if you'd like to call in. All we ask of people who do that is that they're brief, so that we can keep the program moving and get in as many different people as possible. But, of course, anybody's welcome to call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. If you would be listening around Illinois and Indiana, you can use that. And actually, if you might be listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may use the toll-free line. And that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Those are the numbers. Mr. Gibson, hello.
Hi, David.
Thanks for talking with us today.
No, thanks for having me here.
We certainly appreciate it. And I guess maybe indeed the point to begin with is that while there has been, for the past couple of years now, so much focused on the issue of sexual misconduct by priests and the way the church responded to that, that that is layered on top of some other kinds of currents that now have been flowing, and we can talk about some of those things, but it seems that all of this now has really come together. It's been given greater urgency and weight, perhaps, by what's happened recently, but in another sense, this discontent among the people in the pews and also unhappiness of a lot of people in the leadership of the church, those things are not new.
No, definitely not. And the focus, as you say, has been on this sexual abuse scandal, but the scandal is not something that's just sort of unto itself, you know, that just sitting out there. It really is, and what I try to focus on in my book is that it's really the symptom and the outgrowth of a kind of larger dysfunction that's been going on in the church, and there has been that, you know, sort of discontent brewing. Every headline, I think, of the past 20 or 30 years is always about, you know, discontented Catholics here or this or on that. But, you know, I think there are a lot more almost serious issues and more profound issues that I think Catholics hadn't even really been aware of. You know, issues obviously with the priesthood, but issues within the hierarchy, the bishops. And I think this was kind of I use that perfect storm analogy where, you know, all of these things came together, and the sexual abuse scandal was just kind of touched off this outrage in the church. I mean, sexual abuse scandals aren't new. Unfortunately, the first round was in 1985, coming out of Louisiana, and sparked, you know, calls for changes, et cetera. And then in 1992, the Father James Porter case in Fall River, Massachusetts, sparked another round. So, in a way, the sexual abuse was sort of the fuse that set this all off, but people were really so outraged because they felt like they'd been played for fools. So this kind of third strike and you're out, and it kind of really showed the laity, I think, how powerless they truly felt in the church. Mm.
Well, I think that's an important point. I think that, you know, in as much as people felt anger and sadness and outrage and all of those very powerful emotions about these charges. At the same time, it reinforced the feeling that people had for a long time about their position in the church, their relationship to the person who led their parish, and then their relationship to the people, the men who were above that. And it just brought home again to people that it gave them another reason to think that the relationship wasn't what they wanted it to be, and that the hierarchical and authoritarian nature of the church, the way that it's structured, wasn't what they wanted to be. And it's something that people had been talking about, I think, for a long, long time. But this galvanized people, I think, in a way that nothing had before.
Yeah, it was a wake-up call, you know, very much. And people started looking around saying, okay, what is it, you know, about our church? What needs to change? What are the causes of all this? As you say, I mean, we in all of these discussions, we have to keep the victims of sexual abuse, you know, first and foremost in our field of vision. I mean, I always try to do that. But again, this is really, I think, about deeper issues in the church. And frankly, I think, lay people have been rather content, you know, not to delve too deeply into these issues. I think this is sort of forcing lay people to do just that. I mean, they're talking about, you know, a more empowered laity, that is the 99.9% of us in the pews, you know, who are not of the ordained class. But people are really going to have not done that before and don't really know, I think, how to take up those roles in the church. And I think, you know, as much as focusing on doctrine or theological disputes, I like to focus almost on the sort of governance, the politics of the church, which I think is really undergirding this scandal and is also showing a possible way out of the crisis for the church.
Well, what is it, do you think, that people want, that American Catholics want?
There are two things. I think they want, first and foremost, they want leaders, church leaders, especially the bishops. Again, I think Catholics are most upset, rightfully so, I think, with their hierarchy. Obviously, there's the crimes and sins of priests that are being broadcast out here. But again, it's a minority of priests. One is too many. But, you know, so many Catholics have a great parish priest. They have a great experience of the church. So their real concern, I think, is with the leadership. And, you know, that is ultimately responsible for this. Again, it's not the abuse or, you know, it's not the crime, as we always know. It's always the cover-up that gets you, and that's the case in this one as well. But, you know, they just want, it's not so much theological. They want a pastoral bishop. They want somebody who comes and meets them and talks to them and is with them and is a pastor to them, rather than sort of a disciplinarian or just someone who kind of gets up there and reads the latest message from Rome, from on high. And I think, you know, I think nothing is demonstrates that better than the transition in Boston, which, as you know, was, you know, the epicenter of this whole scandal in January 2002, when the Boston Globe first started producing these stories. And Cardinal Law, who was kind of the villain of this whole piece, finally had to step down in December of 2002. I think that was the real turning point, a real, you know, watershed in for the church. The man who replaced him, a Capuchin Franciscan friar, Sean O'Malley, is also very, you know, conservative and on a lot of doctrinal issues, etc. But he's just amazingly human and pastoral and very humble and lives very simply. People respond to that so dramatically. So I think that is number one of what they want, is just bishops who are more pastoral and feel like they're listening. Hmm.
Well, I think you also make the argument that there are a lot of bishops, particularly American ones, who are unhappy about the position in which they find themselves in between their parishioners and Rome, having to, in many cases, having to justify to their parishioners decisions that are handed down from the top that maybe they and the people in the pews are not real happy about.
Yeah, people often don't realize that. I mean, how caught in the middle the bishops are. It's, you know, frankly, it's tough being a bishop these days. You've got to be, as one expert has said, you've got to be Jesus Christ with an MBA from Harvard. You know, you've got to be this wonderful saintly person, and you've also got to make the trains run on time. You've got to raise money. You can't close parishes. You can't close schools. You've got to be all things to all people, and one of those people is the Pope. And it's, you know, under this papacy, which is about to celebrate its 25th, Pope John Paul's 25th anniversary of his reign, there's been a real trend towards centralizing authority over all matters, not just, you know, big doctrinal questions, but all kinds of things in Rome. And that's really created a lot of difficulties for bishops who are just swamped with directives from Rome and you know, are just looking over their shoulder all the time, too much, you know, I think, and that's been a problem. But, you know, it's one of those things that even, I mean, this is cutting across liberal conservative categories. This is kind of across the board. So it's a problem for the bishops. And I think, you know, lay people often don't realize how, how caught in between the bishops are.
This pope has been pope for a long time. In fact, I think he's the fourth longest serving pope in the history of the church. And given that there have been a lot of them, that's saying something.
That's right, 264 all told. Yeah.
But we also know that he is. It's very clearly he is not in good health, and is expected that perhaps sometime in the near future he might not be around anymore. So someone else will be Bishop of Rome. And so I think on the one hand, people think that might be the opportunity for change. On the other hand, they look at the just how conservative the Vatican bureaucracy, the people who really are in power, are, and also the fact that during the time that this pope has been pope, he has appointed a lot of conservative bishops. What do you think is the possibility that things might really change with the next pope?
I think there is a good chance of significant change. I really think it's almost a toss-up. It's a 50-50 shot as to how the next conclave will go. And as you say, I mean, the Pope's health is suffering. I mean, he's got Parkinson's disease, which is a degenerative condition, and people are talking in terms of months rather than years, certainly. But the next Pope, you know, it's not really so much a question, I think, of liberal or conservative. There aren't a lot of liberals out there, but there are a number of moderate to progressive cardinals, surprisingly. I mean, one of the men who was just appointed, Archbishop Keith O'Brien, was just elevated to a cardinal later this month in connection with all the ceremonies going on for the Pope's Jubilee anniversary. He's openly said he wouldn't mind seeing celibacy, wither away, and he's made some comments about artificial contraception, that he'd be open to changing that, things like that. He's obviously not going to become pope, but I think there is that wing of the College of Cardinals in there. The main thing, I think, though, is that, as you say, the Pope John Paul II has been an amazing figure, just a historical figure. He's been there 25 years, though, and in any institution, in any community, there's always that pendulum between centralization and decentralization, and I think the cardinals will be looking for a bit of a break, probably looking for an older pope. John Paul was a very vigorous 58 when they elected him. Maybe they'd be looking for somebody in his mid to late 60s, in reasonably good health, but, you know, maybe a 10-year, 12-year papacy, something like that. And also just someone who would sort of relax the reins of authority from Rome, which could lead to, there wouldn't be any sort of doctrinal or theological revolutions coming out of Rome, but things that would allow bishops to adapt things a little bit more in their local circumstances. And I think that could, in and of itself, prompt real change. I think there is a change in the offing. Obviously, you know, we talk a lot, and I do in the book, about the role of lay people and the need for lay people to step up to the plate in the church and to be empowered. But nothing, it's still a hierarchy, and nothing can change the Catholic Church more quickly than a new pope. I mean, we saw that with John the 23rd, who followed on Pius the 12th.
We have a couple of callers. We'll bring them into the conversation. I'd like to introduce again our guest, David Gibson. He's a religion writer. He is also Catholic himself. He's done a lot of writing about Catholicism for various newspapers and magazines. He also worked for several years for Vatican Radio in Rome. He is the author of a recently published book titled The Coming Catholic Church, How the Faithful Are Shaping a New American Catholicism. It's published by Harper San Francisco. Questions are welcome here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also toll-free, 800-222-9455. We'll start in here with a caller in Aurora, up in the Chicago area. Line four. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I really appreciate this chance to say something, because that's one thing in the Catholic Church, there's no recourse for the parishioners. I was told by a priest that has since retired, he told me not to come to church and don't bring my mother without any reasoning. We were just walking out of the church, and my mother's in a wheelchair, and he tells me that. And then he never came for First Communion on Friday. He never came. The nun that came on Tuesday always said, Father will bring you communion on Friday. He never came. And then I got used to it, and I said, the heck with it. And then when I called him once about 3 or 4 years ago when my mother was doing very poorly, I said, could you come down and give her the last rites? He never came. And I was just incensed. And you have no recourse. When I told the nun, what could she do about it? Nothing. And then the other thing is, I know a church that just spent $2 million on a new church, and then another church, another parish in the vicinity, meets in a burned-out church basement. And I think that kind of Catholicism is not what I think the church has tried to teach me over the years. It's a very sad condition. It's a very sad condition for Catholics. Thank you.
Well, I thank you for the call.
You
Mr.
Know,
Gibson, what do you...
Yeah, you know, David, it's so... It happens, I think, with anything, with any faith or any religion or almost anything. But, you know, the experience one has, I mean, religion is all about personal relationships, be it obviously personal relationship with Jesus, or just, you know, the way you relate to individuals. And the pastor has such enormous influence that, you know, if you have a bad experience of a priest like she had, you know, that can obviously color your views of the entire church. And yeah, I guess I'm one of those fortunate people that I've really, you know, I know a lot of just wonderful priests out there, and some of the, you know, greatest men I know are Catholic priests. And I just, you know, and again, things are all colored by that. And it's one of those things that in this day, especially in these last couple of years, it's one of these things that even faithful Catholics who, you know, who do have wonderful experiences of the church every Sunday, you know, are starting to question, you know, because of the tidal wave of reports and revelations saying, you know, what's going on with our priesthood, what's going on with our church. So there are, you know, it's one of those things that that people are at one level sort of, you know, questioning that relationship and wondering about that relationship that they have with their priest. On the other hand, I think the one thing that's good about it, that can be at least a long-term benefit, is that people are also starting to look beyond just their parish priest or even their bishop or cardinal, and saying, you know, look, these men have done wrong things, but this is still our church, this is still our faith, and they're starting to look at ways that they can, you know, they want to stay Catholic. They want it's the faith and the Catholic Church that they believe in. It was an amazing quotation. You know, God bless him. But as Archbishop Michael Sheehan in New Mexico, after or in Arizona, I think after the bishop O'Brien, Bishop O'Brien, was forced to resign after a number of scandals came out, et cetera. You know, he came in. He's Archbishop Sheehan is one of these fixers, one of these handful of bishops who the Vatican sends around to various dioceses where there have been scandals to help restore things. He's a very pastoral man, very very good at helping to restore the faith and morale of Catholics. And he said, look, don't put your faith in your priest. Don't put your faith in your bishop. Put your faith in Jesus. That's You know, really, if you compare that to what would have been said 30 or 40 years ago, that's a remarkable evolution, and I think a lot of Catholics are doing that, and they want to stay Catholic, but they're not going to let one individual priest or one bishop sort of, you know, ruin their experience of church.
To another caller, we have someone in Champaign on our line one.
Hello. I'm wondering if your book addresses a more reactionary movement in the church, this kind of back to Latin rejection of the Vatican II. I don't know, it seems to be somewhat perhaps associated with a very conservative seminary training priests in Lincoln, Nebraska. And they seem to, you know, kind of have this American conservative view that, you know, the sexual revolution of the 60s has been the downfall of everything. And I'm not sure if they reject the Enlightenment, that they seem to kind of reject a lot of ideas about separation of church and state and perhaps have alliances with, you know, the Christian right.
Well, I do address that right wing of the church, and there's that real hard right. I mean, it's one of these odd things that people often, you know, in the sort of standard narrative of the church in America, it's the liberals who are causing the Vatican agita and giving them trouble all the time, and it's the Pope who's always remonstrating with the liberals. But frankly, it was these arch conservatives, the traditionalists as they're called, who provoked in 1988, I think it was. I was over in Rome at the time. The first schism in more than 100 years. It was the Latin Rite folks who up and left the Catholic Church. In a way, the right wing has caused this this papacy and the church in America more fits than anybody. But I think really, you know, I do sort of analyze that. I think one of the main things I try to hit at is the polarization in the church, which I think is one of, you know, there's so much of the Catholic Church is a church of immigrants that has been steadily assimilating into American society, and that's all to the good. But I think one of the unfortunate things we've taken on is that kind of sharply antagonistic, polarized quality that besets our society today. And I think it's, you know, it's a problem both for the hard left and the hard right. You know, it's not a question of getting women priests tomorrow. That may be an issue for discussion, but, you know, that's not going to address the sexual abuse scandal necessarily. That's, and it's not a panacea to everything, nor is it, on the other hand, you know, reinstating the Latin Mass, which nobody really understood back when they had it anyway. So it's, you know, there's a real polarization here. I think the real problem that the right wing, let's say the conservatives, have is that essentially this happened on their watch. I mean, Cardinal Law, if the Pope had a favorite son in the American hierarchy, it was Cardinal Bernard Law. And in a way, you know, he's, you know, that sort of very corporate style of Catholicism that he represented, you know, circle of the wagon style, I think is really on the hook for much of this scandal. And I think conservatives are having a real tough time dealing with that, and hence their criticism of the bishops has been brutal, just blistering. I mean, you know, if you look at the comments from conservatives, they've been as tough on the bishops and everybody else as, you know, more in tougher language than anyone.
So how do this traditionalist view with the Latin Mass, and are they in any way connected with any, I don't know, I'm just asking because of this film and this controversy, which, you know, I have some questions about the Jewish Defense League as well, and its perhaps terrorist connections, but is there any kind of a revival of anti-Semitism in this traditionalist approach?
Well, they're certainly not the most open-minded on those things. I mean, it's, you know, it's always a problematic thing going back to the days, you know, before John the 23rd took out all the anti-Semitic language, and some of the, like the Good Friday liturgy, for example, is not exactly embracing what John Paul has done. And these are people, you know, John Paul II, you know, is, everybody says, oh, conservative Orthodox Pope. These people are often, you know, really harsh in their criticism of the Pope. They don't accept. He's been, you know, he went to a synagogue. I mean, his openings to Judaism have been profound. I mean, I was just talking to a rabbi the other day as we were talking about the 25th anniversary of the Pope, and he said he's supposed probably more popular among Jews than he is among his own people. And I think But I think this the connection I think you are making between them and Mel Gibson's forthcoming film, The Passion,
which nobody seems to have seen.
is really problematic. Mel Gibson, no relation to me, is I wish I had his checkbook, but he's one of these traditionalist Catholics. I mean, he's a schismatic Catholic essentially. He's built his own parish in L.A., which happens which you can do when you've got enough money, I guess. But it's outside it's not part of the Los Angeles diocese, you know, archdiocese. It's unto itself. I mean, that's not traditional Catholicism in any way, but there's this traditionalist movement that rejects all kinds of things. So they reject the election of every pope since Pius the XII. They think Pius the XII is essentially the last legitimate pope. So there's, again, as I said before, the Vatican, for all its quote-unquote conservative ways, has more problems to deal with on the right, or as many problems, certainly, as they do with the hard left in the church.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. We're a little bit past the midpoint of this first hour of Focus 580, and I should introduce again our guest, David Gibson. He's a religion writer. He worked in Rome for Vatican Radio for several years and has written about Catholicism for a number of newspapers and magazines. He's the author of a recently published book titled The Coming Catholic Church, How the Faithful Are Shaping a New American Catholicism, and it is published by Harper San Francisco. Questions are welcome, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana folks. Also, we do have a toll-free line, 800-222-9455. Next caller is Belgium. That's over by Danville on our line number 4. Hello.
Hello. I'd like to ask a question that I don't want to seem disrespectful with, but I'm not of the faith, but the actions that are happening with this present pope just seem so rude or whatever. The poor man looks like he's just essentially ready to lay down. And somebody keeps propping him up and rolling him out for another showing. I can't understand this. Can you give me some insight into it?
Well, the whole issue of, a pope retiring is a really problematic one, given that it's, in Catholicism, the sacramental view of ordination of this this office of the papacy. It's not, you know, it's got an administrative quality to it or aspect to it, but it is, it's something that Catholics believe that is ordained by the Holy Spirit or guided by the Holy Spirit. So just laying that down is, as I say, a problem. I think, well, the last pope to resign was way back in the 15th century, and that was to end the Great Western Schism. And before that, I think it was a pope in 1297 who resigned. Dante put him in one of the rings of the Inferno, which shows you kind of, you know, what fate awaits you if you resign as a pope. But the bottom line is, with John Paul, they, you know, just certainly to many, they feel very sympathetic and for him, and think that perhaps, you know, he should just lay down this burden and shouldn't be dragged out there, as you say. On the other hand, there's, you know, the Catholics believe very much in and this pope does, in the redemptive value of suffering, and he wants to present an example that, you know, old people are not sort of, you know, it's not a disposable society, a throwaway society, and that he can soldier on, and not just in a suffering way, but also being a man of good cheer. You know, I think he's left instructions someplace in case he becomes incapacitated or certainly mentally incapacitated for some sort of transition, and that will happen with future papacies, thanks to the advances in modern medicine. We're not going to be able to avoid this problem of resignation or retirement in the future. But, you know, for many, you know, he came in 1978 as this 58-year-old skiing, mountain hiking, you know, God's athlete, he was called. And, you know, for years, he survived a martyrdom, an assassination attempt, a kind of virtual martyrdom in St. Peter's Square. He's been this vigorous, vibrant man who's traveled everywhere. Now, at the end of his papacy, he wants to present a different example. And clearly, it's, you know, that point you raise. I mean, there is a fine line between offering up a positive role model for aging and suffering people and just being trotted out there as some kind of, sideshow. So it's a tough thing that again, if his condition continues to degenerate, the problem will probably be moot because I think, you know, it will eventually claim him.
The other aspect I'd like to point out is that at his age, which is, what, 80?
83, yeah.
83, is his mental acuity to handle such a large organization with so many complexities, is he really still capable for the job?
His mental acuity is still good. This is really a physical infirmities we're talking about. I mean, he continues to write. He's a remarkable writer, and you know, everything from poetry to philosophy. There are two things. For one, it's the Vatican isn't really like General Motors, although people like to think it is, and in a way, that's why the Pope was as surprised and shocked, I think, by the revelations coming out of Boston and elsewhere as anybody. It's people like to think the Vatican sort of knows what's going on in every diocese and sort of, you know, they try to manage them maybe like branch offices, but that's not really how it works. The administrative aspects of the papacy aren't really that great. His main jobs are twofold: to appoint bishops, which he has a lot of advice on that, and to protect the faith. So they're really, you know, he's got the Roman Curia there, and each diocese is unto itself and operates unto itself. So it's a really very decentralized operation. And, you know, he's got aides who are really taking over this more than ever. You're right about that. I mean, he's just not involved in the day-to-day stuff the way he used to. And that does, you know, have consequences. I think, for example, even his reaction to the sexual abuse scandal was not as quick and as adept, certainly, as it would have been in days past, where I think he may have spoken out personally or done something a little more proactively. But this is also, you have to remember, this is a pope who really never cared too much for the administrative part of things anyway. He loves meeting people. He's traveled 700,000 miles during his papacy. He's spent almost 10% of his papacy outside of Rome, which up until this papacy was virtually unheard of. Popes were known as a prisoner of the Vatican. His way of dealing with the Roman Curia, the church's bureaucracy, was basically to circumvent them and go directly to the people. So he was never too fond of administration anyway, and that's always kind of been left to his aides.
Thank you, sir.
Sure.
All right, thank you. Let's go to another caller. This is Chicago, line one.
Yes, and I better preface this as saying that I am a Catholic, but the one comment I wanted to make is that I really get annoyed when people continue to present John Paul as a conservative pope. He has been more radical than most American bishops and cardinals, and I think what the American Catholicism has done is to simply ignore his opinions that they can't agree with, and I'm really talking about his attitude on the third world, economics, and human life, particularly the death penalty and war. And what we've done here in the United States is simply ignore all of that and continue to focus on particular social issues that we don't agree with and say that he's very conservative. And I just feel that the real crisis in Catholicism is if we can ever get over a Chinese menu version of Catholicism, like one from column A and one from column B, and we can pick and choose and therefore have our faith. And it's almost as if we really want this to go the easy way. And in my own parish, we see it constantly, the connection to the church and the connection to the faith is really pretty tentative. I mean, we have completely, we've become part of the American culture, and Catholicism is no longer a counterculture in any way, and I don't know if that happened with the election of John Kennedy or what, but it's very important, I think, for most Catholics, American Catholics, to fit into the American mainstream, to embrace all of the attitudes and the aspects of our faith that might call us to things such as nonviolence are just ignored in many ways. So I think in a lot of ways we have the clergy that we deserve as a public, because a lot of Catholics want to just drop in on Sunday and that's it. They don't want to carry their faith any other place. And I'll stop ranting.
I think the author really addresses a lot of that, particularly this issue of how is one both a Catholic and an American. Dave, you deal with that in the book.
A central issue, and it always has been, you know, ever since Catholics first came to this country, before it was a country, in the colonies, and it's always, you know, if there's one thing I think that this sexual abuse scandal pointed out, it's really, again, how different Catholicism is from anything else out there in the landscape. And it's always constantly struggling with that. And you know, I think it still remains very countercultural in many ways. But I think, you know, your caller does make some really good points, and I couldn't agree with her more on the issue of the picking and choosing, which is always, you know, the Catholic conservatives in this country are always saying, oh, liberal Catholics are sort of picking and choosing, but conservative Catholics are doing the same thing. You know, the Pope, that's why I always kind of put it in the word conservative in quotation marks when I refer to John Paul, because if you look at the totality of his teachings, the things he said about social justice, about human rights, about materialism, about capitalism, which he's said is frankly you know, is potentially as dangerous and harmful as communism. That's an amazing statement, and he's been so outspoken on those issues and on those dangers, on the death penalty, which, you know, he sent the Catholic Catechism, which he revamped under his papacy. He sent it back to the printers to have them reinforce even more stronger language that the death penalty is not acceptable under almost any circumstance. And you have Justice Antonin Scalia of the Supreme Court, who's considered kind of the Catholic of you know, Catholic conservatives, saying basically if the Pope is right on that, then the entire faith is a fraud. I mean, really strong language. And again, I think the caller makes a good point. You know, people, you know, we always take what we want, you know, what's the easiest. But Americans have often ignored a lot of what the Pope has said on economic and social justice issues. Whereas, you know, and all of our disputes tend to be over, and all the headlines over issues of contraception and, you know, divorced Catholics, et cetera, which are good debates, but are often so, I think, focused on those to the unfortunate exclusion of a lot of other issues. It's the exact opposite. You know, you go to the Third World, where you've traveled with the Pope, or I've been, you know, covering on assignments, and the Pope is such a hero to them because of the way he speaks out on these issues. It's the exact inverse. The social justice and human rights messages of the Pope make him a hero there.
You know, this. I think one of the things I wanted to get at was this: was the issue of Catholic identity, which is something that fascinates and also, I must say, kind of perplexes me as someone who all of my church experiences as a Protestant. But I certainly have known a lot of Catholics, and many of them really dissatisfied Catholics. And when you suggest to someone like that, well, why don't you just find another church? They look at you as if you're proposing that they become a Buddhist. As I say, it's something that I know it exists, and yet it's something that I don't quite understand. I think, it's, you know, American Catholics always have been a pretty interesting bunch because they have, on the one hand, often been very critical of the leadership and have disagreed on some fundamental points, and at the same time have been very loyal.
Yeah, it's very true, yeah. And I have a whole chapter in the book about that Catholic identity, which I think is the one that occasioned some of the most comment and interest. And that whole issue of staying within or leaving is, in this past year or two, is more intense and central than it ever has been. But, you know, you're exactly right. You know, Catholics are not comfortable with leaving. For one thing, as I said before, you know, we often forget in this kind of melting pot culture we have, Catholicism is extremely different from everything else. You just, you know, mainline Protestantism and certainly evangelical Christianity has amalgamated to a point where, you know, if you don't like the Presbyterian Church down the road, you go to the Methodist Church, or if you don't like the Baptist Church, you go to the mega church in Willow Creek or something like that. You know, you can, there's a lot of more shopping around. Catholics, because of their teachings, you know, about the Eucharist, which is really, again, a central dividing line between Catholics and Protestants, don't feel they can go to other churches so easily. The other big thing is all, you know, the Catholic culture. The closest counterpart, I think, Catholicism has in the religious landscape is to Judaism. I mean, in many ways, Catholicism is about food, holidays, ethnicity. You know, you're not just Catholic, you're Polish Catholic or Lithuanian Catholic or Irish Catholic, Italian Catholic, etc. And there's so much that's bound up in being Catholic. And I think, you know, that, again, like everything, it can cut both ways. It can keep people in the past maybe to just in the organization for the sake of ethnic loyalty or tribal loyalty. But I think, you know, frankly, and what I try to play up, I think it's also, it can be a wonderful thing, and frankly, it can be a wonderful example to American society, where we have this great fragmentation and this great, you know, individualism, and it's such an exalted virtue in America and such a great thing. But there's also, I think, a great virtue to the community that Catholicism represents, and that idea of working things out within the family. And I think, you know, Catholicism is, again, Catholics are becoming more American, and those ties that bind them to the church are loosening, but not nearly to the degree of other denominations, but they are loosening, and that it's a real danger point for Catholicism right now. And yet this scandal has also galvanized, as you said before, galvanized so many Catholics to stay in the church and to effect change and to work it out within the family. And I think if we can do that, I think, and successfully, I think it could really present a great example of perhaps what is needed, a truly countercultural example for the United States society of staying within and rather than cutting and running and heading someplace else. It's obviously, there are good reasons for a lot of people to leave. Obviously, anyone who's been abused or anything like that. I mean, it's amazing some of the people, you know, victims of sexual abuse who stay within the church. Barbara Blaine, who founded SNAP, the Survivors Network for victims of abuse, she's an amazing woman. Still goes to church more than anyone else in her family, I think, from what she told me. So that, again, is like you said, that identity continues to persist. It's more at risk than it ever has been, but I think it can also be the glue and the bridge that could lead the church to a different place.
We have some other callers. We only have about 5 minutes, so I'll try to get at least one, maybe two. Next up is Chicago, line 4.
Yes, I was going to make a point that there's a lot of groups that seem to be trying to exploit the problems in the church to promote their own agenda, which is not really, necessarily Catholic. For instance, some are out there trying to promote women priests, and even on the capital punishment issue, where the Pope, he has been critical of capital punishment, but he hasn't condemned it in all cases. But there are, you know, liberals in the church who will say, well, you know, capital punishment should be abolished altogether. So they kind of distort the teaching and the practice of the church to promote their own agenda, taking advantage of the problems. And what is your opinion on that?
I think that's a real danger and a real problem, and I do think it cuts both ways. I'm trying to be an equal opportunity critic as I try to drive it down the middle in my book, but I think it's there's very much the case. You know, on the left, you've got a lot of these, you know, reform groups that have been around for decades, and sort of, you know, same membership they've had for decades, and the same issues they've had for decades. But I think we've really got to move beyond that. Fine, some of these issues can be brought up and can be discussed. I think there needs to be a lot more dialogue in the church, and I don't believe in shutting things down, whatever the issue. But, you know, again, to say that, dropping celibacy tomorrow would solve the problem, well, it wouldn't either solve the problem of sexual abuse, nor would it solve the issues in the church, which, you know, issues surrounding lay people, surrounding the priesthood, surrounding the hierarchy, nor would women priests, nor would sort of having a constitutional convention in St. Peter's Square to elect a pope. Bottom line democracy, as we've seen in California, can get a little messy. I'm not sure you want to translate that to the Catholic Church. And, you know, a lot of those groups do not. But I do think, you know, people are using some groups on the fringes. Again, I think it's this problem of polarization. Some of these fringe groups are using the crisis to, you know, to play up their agenda again. But again, it works on the right wing just as well.
Well, thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. We're at the point here, we're just going to have to stop. We have a couple of minutes left. And as a way of finishing up, I do want to ask you about the idea that there might, Catholics, American Catholics, might be headed towards a new American Catholicism, as the subtitle in the book suggests. I suppose some people would say, in a way, there has been a de facto, if not de jure, American Catholic Church for some time now. What do you think, if indeed there is this movement toward something new, what would it look like?
Well, I definitely think the church is certainly going to be more lay-led, and that's just been happening. Again, very much what I try to do in the book is to focus on the idea of the way the church changes, the way it is changing, even under this papacy. And under this papacy, lay ministry has grown, the role of women has grown. A lot of these things are going to be continuing on, I think, in the future. And that's just, those are the trend lines that are happening. It's how the Vatican and the hierarchy deal with it will be really central to the future of the church. But, you know, it's, again, the church is always changing. It's just a question of how it's going to change and exactly what direction it's going to go in. So I really try and illuminate those perspectives and offer, hopefully through that, a sense of hope, if not optimism. It's tough to be optimistic now, but, I mean, I think it's really we're not going to have an American Catholic Church. I think it's that is held out there, but often. But, frankly, each national church in every country is so different within this great Catholic umbrella. And American Catholics, frankly, are very loyal to Rome, more than any other church in the industrialized world. We go to church more, give more money to the papacy than any other flock in the world. So it's not, you know, it's unfortunately, I think the choice is between, you know, Catholics just sort of leaving or just sort of a slow-motion enervation of the church and a sort of transformation that keeps people in and I believe can also draw a lot more people into the church.
I'd just like to ask real quick, and it's probably not enough time to give you a chance to talk about it, but you were not born a Catholic. You converted when you were an adult. What drew you to Catholicism?
That's a long answer. That's probably in the next book. But I think in short, and having converted after, you know, working at the Vatican is a miracle in and of itself, as some would say. I think the Eucharist, as I say, the central, what I think is the summit and source of Catholic life. But it's you know, it's also the whole complexity of the beauty of the church that really drew me, and I think it's a wonderful thing in many ways, being able to choose your faith. I was sort of raised an evangelical Christian, but to be able to choose it in midlife or in adult life, because you often don't have a lot of the baggage that everyone else, or the bad experiences everyone else does. So, you know, I think even for the whole church to kind of look at the, you know, Catholics to look at the church with the eyes of a convert can be a useful tool these days when we're looking for reasons to hope.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us today. We appreciate
great.
It.
Thank you.
Our guest, David Gibson, he's a religion writer, worked for a number of years in Rome for Vatican Radio, has written for various newspapers and magazines, pieces about Catholicism. His book is The Coming Catholic Church, How the Faithful Are Shaping a New American Catholicism, published by Harper San Francisco.